First case on our calendar is 0199, State of Ohio versus Kevin Walls. Mr. Fredericks.
May it please the court, my name is Scott Frederick and I'm here on behalf of the appellant Kevin Walls in this matter. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your honors, the appellant raises two very important issues in his brief in this matter, both of which are of great significance in this case. However, I'd like to focus main portion of my time this morning on the first proposition in appellant's brief. However, certainly I would entertain any questions that that you may have in regard to the prejudicial delay to the appellant as well. Article 1, Section 10 of the United States Constitution, as well as Section 28, Article 2 of the Ohio Constitution, prevents the Ohio legislature from passing laws to be applied retroactively in a case such as this. There are many important cases cited in appellant's brief that are authority for reversal in this matter, but I would like to discuss a few of them this morning. The one I think is probably the most significant and important, your honors, is Carmel versus Texas. In that case, it's a 2000 United States Supreme Court case where the Supreme Court goes into a great historical analysis of the ex post facto provision in the Constitution. As early as 1796, Justice Chase and Calder v. Bull gave definition to this principle, which is still very viable today. There's a four-part definition that must be applied to the situation herein. First, we have to ask, does the law make an action done before passing the law criminal? This court has gone through great analysis in several cases where they have stated that juvenile proceedings are civil proceedings. I think the answer to the first question is yes. The difference between a juvenile proceeding and a criminal proceeding is obvious on its face, and N. Ray Anderson, this court, noted that. So certainly, I think there is a change in the fact that this new passing, this new statute 2151-26, changes an offense that was once civil in nature to a criminal offense automatically. The second question is, does it aggravate the seriousness of the crime? Going back to the first question, I think it takes something that would be handled in a civil context and clearly makes it criminal automatically. Third, the question is, or the part of the definition that we have to apply and ask, is does the new law inflict greater punishment? There's absolutely no doubt in this case that by retroactively applying this law to Appellant Walls, that he is looking at the possibility, or was looking at the possibility as a juvenile at the age of 15 of up to 6 years or up to age 21 at the Department of Youth Services versus the sentence that he received of 20 years to life.
The fourth, counsel, under the old law, would have been possible for him to have been bound over?
Justice Pfeiffer, in this case, yes, it would. I believe in the mid-90s, the age for bind over changed from 15 to 14. If he had been 14 at the time, I think the answer would be no. But since he was 15, he is subject to bind over, absolutely.
So if the process in this case had started out in juvenile court,
yes,
he could still have been bound over and end up exactly where he is right now.
Absolutely.
With no constitutional issue.
If the proceedings had taken place, the amenability hearings as required, certainly he could have been bound over.
Right.
And I believe even at the trial court level that issue was raised, and the choice by the state for some reason whatsoever was not to take that extra step. They wanted to push it through the common pleas level.
How do you evaluate their ability to be rehabbed when they're 21, or as another case we had, when they're in their 40s.
Well, luckily, Justice, I don't have to, that problem, that is something that the juvenile court would have to deal with. It's something that I think that they...
Can they look at this gentleman's actual track record and the fact that he continued to live, or he lived a life of crime, and say, you know, when you look in retrospect, he would absolutely be bound over because he has not been rehabilitated and therefore no prejudice?
I think that the juvenile court could certainly make that finding, looking at the factors as required by law.
Can we not make that finding, looking at his record, saying, you know, he was not rehabilitated, he continued a life of crime, he therefore has no prejudice to the fact that he didn't have his bind-over hearing because he would have ended up right where he is?
Well, I certainly do not think that this court has the ability to make that finding. I think that that has to be a finding after the procedural safeguards are placed at the juvenile level for the hearing.
But we evaluate errors on a basis of, you know, prejudice in deciding whether to reverse, and if we find harmless error because he ends up no differently than where he started, then why do we put the system through a vain act?
Justice, I think that this court has answered that question on a few different occasions. The first would be State versus Golfin. And the issue in that case was simply that the juvenile didn't have a physical examination. It was part of the process of the amenability hearing. He actually did have the hearing, but because the offense that would have occurred happened prior to the amendment of the statute, this court felt that the prior statute should apply, that the physical examination itself was substantive, not just procedural, not just something that could be perfunctory and dismissed or done away with, and actually made the, you know, made them go back in the proceedings and said that it was a jurisdictional issue. And the Common Pleas Court in that case, and the same here, didn't have proper subject matter jurisdiction because the procedure wasn't followed, which is, I think we get down to the basic premise here is it's a jurisdictional flaw, a jurisdictional defect.
But the Court of Appeals said that the Common Pleas Court had jurisdiction, that a court is able to determine its own jurisdiction, because they did have jurisdiction over this person since he was an adult.
Correct. I think that the Court of Appeals in this case certainly said that, but I think this court has stated on several occasions, most recently I believe it was in the Timmerman case, which affirmed Wilson dealing with jurisdictional issues for juveniles. And it says that the juvenile court has exclusive original jurisdiction, and I think that's true
in
this case.
Of juveniles.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. And you have to look back to the date when the offense occurred versus the age of the person when the charge comes about. And that's the crux. It's the date of the juvenile when the offense occurred.
I understand the ex post facto argument, and it's probably your strongest argument here, but there's also a very strong argument on the second issue, that is, was the delay prejudicial?
Correct.
And I'm concerned just about one part of the evidence, and that's with regard to the Pilla case.
Okay.
And the Pilla case, at the time of the discovery, I think in 1985, had bloodstains on it.
Correct.
DNA was not really readily available then in 1985, so it was not tested. In 98, or whenever we do this, whenever they're doing this, then they seem to test the blood splotches from the Pilla case, but the Pilla case can't be found. Is there any causal chain of custody of the evidence from blood stains that they now test in 98 that relates it directly to the Pilla case in 1985?
Justice, not that I'm aware of. I think part of the issue that you're hitting on, and it's not just the Pilla case, which is very important, but there were many other items of evidence that were lost. Their value was lost. Blood evidence, as this court knows today, is very crucial and important.
Yeah, that's why I'm staying with that. I understand the other items of evidence. I'm talking about the Pilla case.
Correct.
They didn't find the Pilla case. They still haven't found the Pilla case.
That's right.
How did they get the blood swatches? What did they test? Did they take a swatch, or does it indicate they took a swatch from the Pilla case in 1985 and that was preserved?
I don't have...
I don't either, but that's...
I don't have an absolutely understanding of that from the record, Your Honor.
Okay, because that was a very important piece of evidence in this conviction.
That's correct. That's correct. Well, in the sense that I think it showed that the blood was the same type as the victim's, I also think that there was some DNA analysis that was done that showed that the blood was not
hers. Yes.
Hers. Of course, if we had the benefit of that, there could be additional analysis done to rule out.
Yeah, but see, then you jump. You make the quantum leap. You have to start with, do you not? Is this the blood from that pillowcase? Not how. What did it test when we test it? Do we know that this is the blood from the pillowcase, and how do we know that?
I don't believe so, and I think that's part of the problem with the length of delay and the fact that this evidence through that period of time could have been in any number of places, put any, you know, a lot of it was misplaced. Who knows if it'll ever be found, but that's part of the problem in that issue. I do want to go back to the ex post facto argument. I think this court has dealt with the issue on many occasions, and Carmel versus Texas is very helpful. I think the court found in analyzing the factors that we were just talking about, just because there was a change in the quantum of evidence that was required to convict the defendant, that the new provision, it was an evidentiary provision in that case, could not be applied retroactively. Now, that case was somewhat of a hybrid because there were certain factual allegations that occurred prior to the new law being put into effect and certain factual allegations that would have occurred after. And the court did not unsettle the convictions for the alleged crimes that occurred after the statute was put into place, only previous. And I think the state hints in their brief that if you buy into the appellant's proposition that criminal laws could never be changed in the state of Ohio, and that's certainly not the appellant's position in this case. Senate Bill 2 is a very strong example of that. And it changed the entire sentencing structure in the state of Ohio. Some crimes, the punishment was increased, some they were lessened. But in that situation, it was clearly stated that it's the day that the act occurred, not the day that the charge came about, that determines when you are sentenced. In fact, the appellant Kevin Walls in this case was sentenced under the old law because that was the proper way to sentence him. He was not sentenced under the law in 1996 or 1997 or 98 when they started to investigate the possibility of him being involved.
If you do, how do you dispute the fingerprint evidence? We have the same problem with the fingerprints, that they couldn't identify him back there, and then later when we get the fancy new equipment, they put him into the new equipment and go back and find that five or six of the latent prints were matched directly to his. How do you...
I certainly believe that the record supports the fact that his fingerprints were found in the premises. That alone does not prove that he committed a murder.
Well, except he said he never knew her.
He did. Back when he was interviewed, when he was 15, he said that he did not know the woman. He was shown a picture from a driver's license, and he did not recall knowing that woman. I think later on, he said that maybe he did grow up in that area. He may have done some work for her as part of a project with a group called Rent-A-Kids. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frederick. Mr. Eichel.
May it please the court, if I may, before discussing the more involved issue of the retroactivity provision in the state constitution and the ex post facto issue in proposition law number one, I'd like to just for a minute or two discuss the state's position with respect to the proposition of law number two, the pre-indictment delay issue. To answer Justice Douglas's question, that pillowcase, which was obtained from, not from the defendant's home, not from the victim's home, but from a third party's home, this person that allegedly was a suspect at the time, way back when, 14, 15 years ago. That pillowcase was sent to BCI. BCI preserved a swatch from the pillowcase of the blood stain contained on that pillowcase. It turned out to be the same blood type O as the victim. However, in 1998, BCI, retaining that evidence, at the request of the prosecution, at the request of the detective, had BCI submit this for DNA analysis. DNA analysis proved that this was not Anna Zweifelhafer's blood. It was not her DNA.
Where'd the pillowcase go? Nobody seems to know.
It either stayed at BCI and was taken, something happened to it there, or something happened to it at the Hamilton Police Department. We don't
somehow
know.
Somehow, the evidence was lost.
Yes. It proves, however, that there's nothing in the chain of evidence. The chain of evidence is intact, and there's nothing incriminating or exculpatory in that evidence. It was taken from a third party's home, and it doesn't incriminate the third party. It doesn't exonerate the defendant. As this court has held in State versus Luck, State versus Whiting, and the Lovasco and Marion cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, what is required to find a due process violation is, number one, an unjustifiable delay, pre-indictment delay, which, number two, results in actual prejudice to the defendant's defense. This two-part test, of course, as explained in State versus Whiting, as first the defendant bears the burden of proving actual prejudice, and if that burden is met, then the state has the burden to prove that there is some justification for the delay. The case at bar is quite distinguishable from State versus Luck, where there was an inexcusable neglect that caused the delay in investigating the case where Mrs. Luck was the original suspect. 15 years of delay until a new prosecutor, a new investigator decided, let's look at this case again. And then after this court suppressed the statement that was given by Mrs. Luck, the court had nothing before it but the state going forward with no new evidence at all. A 15-year delay in which alibi witnesses died. That's proof of prejudice. That's proof of unjustifiable delay. That's the Luck case. In the case at bar, Mrs. Zweifelhafer's death was unsolved for 14 years. Kevin Walls became a suspect only after his prints were identified as matching those from the crime scene by the AFIS automated fingerprint identification system at BCI in 1998. And immediately upon that probable cause, the state brought the indictment. Mr. Walls' prints themselves, this is very important in this case, Mr. Walls' prints were not available to the state until at the earliest 1995, when he was first incarcerated in the state system. Those prints then were loaded into the AFIS machine, the computer data bank, with four million other prints, and the prints submitted in 1998 to that data bank and matched. The trial and appellate courts below correctly held that the defense failed to show actual prejudice resulting from the delay. They failed to show any exculpatory evidence lost as a result of the delay, but only speculative prejudice in regards to the lost memories and speculation that doesn't meet the level of Marion and Lovasco. In addition, there is no doubt the Court of Appeals said it's conclusory that delay was eminently justifiable. They used those words. The state couldn't go forward unless it had probable cause. Going to the heart of the matter, proposition of law number one, the ex post facto issue, I'd like to hasten to point out, was given birth in this court. When this issue was given birth in the trial court, and I have a copy of the August 16th, 1999 motion filed by the defendant's motion to dismiss. This is based solely on the state constitutional provision. There is not a word uttered in the motion at the trial court level with regard to ex post facto, the federal constitution, nada. This court's decision in State versus Cook outlines that there are two separate functional methods of analysis, one for state constitutional retroactivity, and the other for federal ex post facto analysis. These issues concern similar concerns. However, there are different bodies of case law and different concerns to be met by, under each method of analysis. I point this out because under this court's precedence, State versus Williams, paragraph 1 of the syllabus, and more recently, State versus Hill decided last year, this court will only review for plain error where the trial court has not been allowed to even discuss the issue. The state submits that there is no error here because under the federal ex post facto analysis, there is no ex post facto application of the law. I invite this court's attention to three decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court. First, Collins versus Youngblood in 1990. Second, California Department of Corrections versus Morales in 1995. And the most recent, Garner versus Jones, decided in the year 2000, the same year as Carmel versus Texas. These cases clearly disavow the language heavily relied on by appellant from Weaver versus Graham. And to quote the portion of from Morales, footnote 3 at 514 U.S. page 506, footnote 3, our opinions in Lindsay, Weaver, and Miller suggest that enhancements to the measure of criminal punishment fall within the ex post facto provision because they operate to the quote-unquote disadvantage of covered offenders. But that language was necessarily to the results in those cases and was unnecessary to the results in those cases and is inconsistent with the framework developed in Collins versus Youngblood. After Collins, the focus of the ex post facto inquiry is not on whether a legislative change produces some ambiguous sort of disadvantage, quote unquote, nor, as the dissent seems to suggest, on whether the amendment affects a prisoner's opportunity to take advantage of provisions for early release, but it focuses on whether any such change alters the definition of criminal conduct or increases the penalty by which a crime is punishable.
And isn't that the aspect here that if the appellant is raising anything here, that it's that the crime was made, the punishment for the crime was more burdensome, which is from Youngblood.
That's his argument, but I wish to demonstrate otherwise. In other words, what I'm saying is Collins' decision focuses on the issue that this has to fit within the four categories of Calder versus Bull. The Collins, Morales, and Garner cases compel this court to view the nature of the claimed lost right, in this case, the right of a 21-year-old person arrested for a crime committed as a juvenile, to a juvenile bindover in juvenile court. This court has to focus on what that bindover means and decide whether there is any increased punishment for this class of defendants, these 21-year-olds. That's what the statute changes. In the case at bar, the covered crimes are a felony committed by a person when he was under the age of 18, but not apprehended until after the age of 21. This statute applies prospectively after March 31, 1997, because that's a jurisdictional statute, and it took effect on the date of its enactment. State versus Hawkins is the case I would cite for that proposition. But the nature of the juvenile court bindover is whether this person in the juvenile court is amenable to the juvenile process, to treatment, to rehabilitation in the juvenile system. State versus Douglas, this court's decision, and many other decisions discussing the juvenile court bindover, focus on and contemplate the juvenile's current status. What is his mental, physical, requires physical and mental examinations. What is the nature of the crime? The safety of the community is to be taken into account. And the essence of this is that a juvenile court has nothing to offer a person over the age of 21 in the way of rehabilitation, in the way of treatment, in the way of punishment, as far as that's concerned. after the age of 21, a person cannot be held in juvenile court. Where does that put us with the safety of the community? And one of the considerations that's supposed to be decided at the amenability hearing. What we have here is a case that's very distinguishable from the case cited by the defense, United States versus Juvenile Male. In that case, it arose out of North Carolina, but it was a federal prosecution of a person who committed a crime in 1981. In 1981, there was no, the Juvenile Delinquency Act in the federal statutes did not allow the government to prosecute an individual as an adult for a crime committed at the age of 15. Under the terms of the act then, in effect, the defendant could only be prosecuted in federal court in North Carolina only as a juvenile and then only held until he reached the age of 21. We don't have that situation in the case of Barr. We have a situation where the defendant was eligible at age 15 to be bound over. Under the statute 2151-26 as it existed in 1985, a child over the age of 15, committing an act could be bound over and be tried as an adult. So the United States versus Male case has no applicability here. What we see, and the reason I ask the court to look closely at Collins versus Youngblood, Morales versus the Morales case and the Garner case, is that these cases compel the court to view the nature of the claimed lost right. And in Garner versus Jones, they make it very clear. The controlling inquiry is whether a retroactive application creates a sufficient risk of increasing the measure of punishment attached to the covered crimes. The covered crime in this case being a crime committed by a person now over the age of 21 when he was a juvenile. There is no possibility, zero possibility, of this person being treated in the juvenile system. The right to a bind-over hearing in this instance is ephemeral, and Collins versus Youngblood, Morales, and Garner cases would hold under this analysis. There is no ex post facto violation. There is also, in the federal area, a considerable body of case law, Daubert versus Florida, Gutt versus State, Basel versus Ohio, and Collins versus Youngblood itself, all of which state that a procedural matter does not concern the ex post facto clause so long as there is no change in either the crime definition or the punishment or any defense to that crime. I submit we did prosecute Kevin Walls under the crime as it existed in 1985, that the punishment applied here was the punishment as it existed in 1985. I submit to the court's attention a decision of a sister state, that of People versus Pena, the sister state of Illinois. It's found at 747 Northeast 2nd, 1020. In that case, very similar situation. The person, the increased penalty, the statute applied retroactively was procedural, held to be procedural, and did not increase the penalty for acts committed, thus could be retroactively applied. I'd first further submit that the trial court and the Court of Appeals applied this court's precedents in holding that the jurisdictional statute here, effective March 31st, 1997, was prospective in application to define the court's jurisdiction prospectively after March 31st, 1997.
And do you are you conceding that this was retroactively applied, counsel? The Court of Appeals
much
course,
like
takes different view.
Yeah, much like your to answer your question, much like the court's decision in State versus Cook, it's a case that had prospective application to this case with retrospective effect.
Oh.
With an intended legislative retrospective effect.
In as much as it relies on antecedent facts, is that why?
That's exactly it, yes, under Plavkan and those cases.
Thank you, Mr. Eichel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Frederick, you've saved a little over a minute of your time.
The law doesn't require a futile act. What prejudice did your client suffer by not going through the juvenile bindover procedure?
Well, I think what the state would like to have this court do is just make a determination that, based upon what we know, that he wasn't amenable. The problem with this statute is that it's jurisdictional, and that's what makes this situation unique. And that's why, you know, the ex post facto and the plain argument error by the state, it doesn't work, because you can't waive jurisdictional issues. It just so happens that the ex post facto application of this statute is a jurisdictional situation versus maybe dealing with punishment or something else. This court has already touched on this issue previously in State Ex Rel Weyrung versus Dinkelocker. In that decision, in a dissent written by Justice Pfeiffer and joined by Justice Resnick, it was stated that this court should determine that the Court of Common Pleas, and this is evaluating the same statute, patently and unambiguously lacks jurisdiction because the only authority the lower court can point to in asserting jurisdiction is a statute that must be applied retroactively and therefore unconstitutionally, in that case, 38 years into the past. And it's the same statute we're talking about here today. It's the same situation. Now, that issue wasn't determined in that case because it came here on different procedural grounds. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Frederick. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.